Thank you for your notes. And I apologise for not putting larger pieces of paper out there for you to write on. Because they're hard enough to read, but trying to write them as well on a tiny little stamp of paper. So I'll have to remember that. Some of them are more... some of them are quite long, and there's parts of them which I can probably have a look at, and some of them might be more useful to talk one-to-one with. So, and I'm not sure we'll get through all of them, but let's see. Often when you ask a question, you're not just asking for yourself. There's shared themes in a group like this often. So, okay. I'll literally just start and see. How does an ordinary practitioner... is there any of them in here? How does an ordinary practitioner know that mindfulness and meditation truly is something genuine and not just a false feeling created by self-conviction and bias? So don't worry, I won't read any names. I noticed that hardly any of you actually left names on the notes anyway, so I wouldn't read out a name. How does a practitioner know that mindfulness and meditation is something genuine and not just a false feeling created by self-conviction and bias? So when I read this, the first sort of a bell that goes off in my mind is doubt, the hindrance of doubt. A kind of, is my practice true or false? Is my practice, is it genuine or not genuine? Is my practice genuine or not genuine? I don't know. What's the difference? How do you know if it's genuine? Oh, how are you supposed to tell if it's genuine? Which is a great question. And it might not be that it's doubt speaking at all, but it might also be that it is. So there's something that you might want to check out. Does asking this question, what happens when you write, this is obviously an important question if you've written it on the board and you want to respond it. When you ask the question, what's the emotional energy? What's the mood like when you ask this question? Is there insecurity, worry, uncertainty, these kind of emotions around? If there are, then be aware of that. Have some awareness of that. That might be a large part of what's needed to respond to a question like this. Is my practice genuine, or is it just a false feeling? I can't see my own biases and my own blind spots, so how do I know I'm actually practicing properly? Well, in a way we don't. But isn't it better to understand mindfulness work, mindfulness practice, not so much about as, okay, we discover what mindfulness is and then we just do lots of it. Well, I know what mindfulness is, now I'm just going to do more and more of it until I get what I want, or until something good happens, or deep insights, or calm, or whatever, we get some fruits. But mindfulness is something, it's more like we don't just discover what mindfulness is and then just do lots of it. It's more like deepening our understanding of what it is to pay our attention to our life. Pay attention, give our attention to our life. I've probably heard the word mindfulness, like, I don't know, more than 20 years ago. And I'm still like, it's still hard to kind of really define it in a way that's satisfying. I mean, you can do it, and it's useful to do it. And, you know, John Kabat-Zinn is a very clear definition of it, which I can't remember. but there's something about how to be open about what it is we're learning here. A discovering of our capacity to give our attention and to discover wholesome intentions like loving kindness. And doubt gets cleared up in time. We become clearer that, oh yeah, I know how to come back to myself in a way that's grounding and really valuable. And that takes some time to get that confidence. If the confidence isn't there, we don't give up, we just keep trying. If we get stuck in doubt, you know, we just keep showing up. We keep trying because we know there's something really valuable and important here. And it's great to have questions about our own biases, isn't it? Because, of course, we all have such strong, you know, temperaments and characters and ways of working, which might look different to the people around us. One of the ways that we learn about our own particular biases is through talking and communicating and practicing with other people, isn't it? Because then we disagree and we realise, oh, I really think this and Sampo really thinks that. And that's weird because I kind of trust Sampo, but I kind of trust myself too. So what's really true here? So by doing that, then we discover what our biases are and we can question them in a useful way. And finding that which is genuine in practice. There's, in my own experience, and this is very personal to me in my own character and temperament and exploration, but I remember there was a teacher meeting at Guy House. This was some time ago now. Maybe it was even 8 years ago. I can't remember when it was. But, you know, lots of the teachers from America came over and from the continental Europe. And at one point I ended up in a small group with Joseph Goldstein, Christina Feldman, and Ajahn Chandasiri, who's the head monk. It was the head nun, sorry, of the Chithurst Thai Forest Monastery in England. And then me, who's just done a few retreats, if hardly done any teaching at all. And the small group was, you know, what's your practice? So that was... it wasn't scary at all, amazingly. They were so unscary. It was really nice. And I can't really remember what they said, but I can remember what I said. And I said that the two things that I can come back to where I don't get stuck in doubt, one of them is the don't know mind. Or, you know, when you look at the stars at night and you're like, what is this? Why is there anything? Huh? How come there is just not nothing in the universe? Or really, actually, what am I behind all of these thoughts and feelings and sensations? It's so mysterious. I really do not know what I am in my most fundamental core. And that sort of don't know mind, when I'm like, sometimes the mind just gets stunned into silence. It's like, what? All the mind quietens down. It's like, what? What is this? It's life. What? And then there's no doubt, weirdly. There's no like, oh, but, you know, should I do this? Should I do that? Thinking about metaphysics and philosophy, that's not there. There's just stunned silence and presence. Like, oh? So that's one thing for me that I trust that feels genuine. And the other place where I can come back to is when I look at another person and I think, oh yeah, they, in their own way, however different I may be from them, they want happiness and they don't want suffering, like me. And I don't doubt that. I don't think you're robots. I think you're sentient beings who are sensitive to suffering and want to be well. And I just don't doubt that. It's like a knowing. We could talk philosophy about that. You could disagree with that philosophically, of course. That's fine. But as a practice, as a useful sort of thing to practice with, that to me feels genuine. It's like, I trust that. I don't doubt that. You're there. You're looking out of your eyes and you want life to be well and you don't want to get sick and stub your toe and lose your job. Whatever it might be. So maybe with this question, you know, find what's the sort of the more pure interest in your practice, what are you really here for? I reckon there'll be something genuine in that. What is it that moves you to come and do a retreat? Do you want any more on this one? Whoever asked it? It's tricky to get to know doubt. It's really useful to get to know the kind of doubting corners and places you get caught in, if that's what's happening there. Right, some of these are in categories. These ones are a bit shorter, so maybe I'll... So there's two here which seem to me to come together. How to do metta for your life partner. Sometimes closest are hardest. How to do metta for life partner. Sometimes closest are hardest. And then how to deal... Actually, this one's a little bit different. Yeah, let's look at this one. How to do metta for your life partner. I don't really know. I'm honest. I think it's really hard, isn't it? Maybe you have to have enough self-time to be able to find the metta. Yeah, no, I'm confused about this one too. I think it's tricky because doing metta is so much more complicated with somebody that you're so close to, isn't it? But try it and see. Maybe bring them into your sitting practice. See what happens. See what comes up. It might be that all sorts of things come into the meditation practice. You know, anger, jealousy, frustration, lust, confusion, doubt. It might be that these things take over. If they do, then what metta would want to do is learn to work with these through communication and through talking, I would have thought. And at the same time, there's also tremendous potential for really deep love and connection, isn't there? When you're in a really close relationship with somebody, that's when you can, if you work with the harder stuff, then the fruits of that can be that there's times where you feel really close and really trust, and you can really be yourself. But I think one of the clues is you have to learn how to communicate about the difficult stuff, which is really hard. I think another thing is making sure you have enough of your own space and your own time to get clear on what you want to say, what it is that's important to you, and to have space to reconnect with the goodwill. If it's too tricky, you spend too much time together, and you never get a chance to rediscover your kind of affection, maybe. Then it gets tricky. I don't know. I'm not really sure about this one. Anybody else got any clues on this one or any answers? How to do metta for your life partner? Be present with them. Learn to really listen. Learn to really listen to yourself so you know what you need to say. Take time. Get support to discover what it is that you really need and want and need to say and want to say. And learn how to say that without blame. Say what you need without blame, if you can. Say how you're feeling without blaming the other person for making you feel that way. That's a piece of the puzzle, isn't it? If you can communicate a feeling without blaming somebody else for how you're feeling, that's got metta in it. That's got the wisdom that understands that our own feelings are first and foremost our own business. Anybody got anything to say on this one? Is that a hand back there? Mikael.
One thing that comes to my mind when I hear this question, and I have asked this myself, is that often I'm kind of afraid to ask because I'm afraid to hear the true answer. Sort of, I'm afraid of the response. What if it's not the response that I would like to have when doing metta for my life partner? As you mentioned, it can be very tricky. It can bring up lots of difficult emotions. And at least for me, it's scary.
Mm.
This level also, or these emotions also, what does it mean for this relationship? For me it's a lot about fear. Fear of asking, fear of hearing the true answer, fear of being honest. And dealing with that also with metta, taking it in.
So part of the puzzle is learning to work with your own stuff. Making sure you have the situations to be able to process your own fear and worry and the challenges that come up in the relationship. Because maybe you need to get support from somebody other than your partner to be able to work with the stuff. That's just what came to my mind. I'm confused, I don't know really, I think it's difficult. Sampo?
Just a simple answer is to connect with the love, with the life partner. There probably is a deep love and a deep affection.
Mm.
And connecting it with that and kind of letting go of the problematic stuff that comes, kind of finding where it's easy with the imagination, with memory, bringing to mind something that's lovely.
What came up to me also was perhaps using imagination and not so much seeing the other person as a partner, but perhaps seeing the other person as a child, as a human.
Yeah, something about we see partners in such a certain way, don't we? But they're just another person as well.
I also think it's useful to distinguish that metta is not romantic love, they're two different things.
Yes, romantic love can have a kind of a strong obsessive dimension to it sometimes. Possession and obsession and
endless yearning.
Yeah, it doesn't get satisfied.
Yeah.
Whereas metta's more about letting somebody be as they are and not owning them, being present with them.
Yearning for the loved one might not be an owning or a clinging, but this exploration of wanting to know, wanting to connect, wanting to discover.
I have
actually that, when practicing metta, but that actually kind of makes this more clinging, lusting kind of desire to fade more and opens up more what the other person needs.
Yeah.
And then it becomes kind of like more beautiful and more genuine.
Nice to hear. I can relate. Mm. Daniel.
And it can be really interesting to take like an insight view and ask, who are you and what do you need? And be patient with that. If it goes to fighting, just no, let's not do this and ask again until it goes deeper and deeper. So it can be first, can be really difficult, and emotions come and it goes to back to the difficult things, but it's just be patient and ask again until it goes to.
You mean ask them to their face?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who are you? What do you need?
Who are you?
It can be really interesting.
Right, here's another one which is related. How to deal with an obsessive, addicted mind with practice? Obsession or addiction to something, or rather for someone, another person. This links into what we're saying, how, you know, when we fall in love with somebody and we really get attracted to them, that can have a, it can be crazy, can't it? It can be like a roller coaster. It can be so, get really, really sucked into the energy of love and romantic obsession, and there's a lot of power in that. And I think like what Yusuf was saying, metta does really help in a way. I think the metta can really cut through our objectifying of somebody as the thing that we need and want, and we start to realise, oh, there's another person behind all of this stuff in my mind that, and I don't know that. And there's lots I don't know about them actually. I wonder how they actually are. So it makes a shift from there, like this thing that we want, which maybe is totally appropriate and okay, but we can also find some space around that and we can see through that a bit. And it's like, hello, mysterious other, who I'm so convinced will solve all my problems. Who are you? Or, yeah, can I be present and listen and look more deeply and see what I notice? Yeah, I think, and if you have a strong obsessive thing with somebody, and they keep coming into your mind, and you can't stop thinking about them, and it's, you know, it's romantic or sexual, or it's charged, and it's just very strong. You can, you know, take time and just, who is this person that I'm imagining? Be well. I wish you well, person. Be well. Be well. May be well, and see how that affects the way that you're imagining them and the way that you experience them. I think there's something really interesting that can happen there. And then there's also becoming more aware, isn't there? Noticing the mind keeps going down this one track again and again, and it's got a lot of history. Isn't awareness the thing that helps change our habits? We become more aware of it. Noticing when it's happening, noticing things that trigger us. Maybe we need to have some, to be really careful if we choose to be around the person that's triggering us, that we're getting obsessive with. I mean, there's a classic thing in retreats called Vipassana romance. And they even, you know, some people just call it VR because it's so common. It's not like VD, it's VR. And it's like, yeah, I'm having another VR, I'm afraid. And then there's Vipassana Vendetta, that's the other one. Somebody just really annoying you. And they just, I'm so annoyed, this person. Like, oh, yeah, this person, he's never spoken to you, but if only I could have him. So it happens probably quite a lot, really. Some ways it's really tricky. Sometimes it's really tricky, and sometimes it's not so hard to work with. But I remember being on a long retreat, and being madly in love with somebody who was working at the retreat centre. I couldn't concentrate. I really couldn't concentrate. It was really hard. My whole retreat changed. I had to, okay, something else has to change here. I can't. My original intention has just been destroyed by this romantic obsession. So it was useful in a way I didn't expect it to be. God, we get, I mean, I don't really know. Again, it's such a deep question. We get so tangled, don't we? I'm just aware of how many questions there are. So that was obviously not a comprehensive answer to that question, but anyway. Sorry, I can't read that one. Oh yeah. I'd be interested in hearing your advice on how to approach, from a practice point of view, intense negative feelings and thoughts such as anger, hatred and sadness. So, how to practice with anger, hatred, and sadness. I want to bring a point of view about love and kindness. I think it would be important to talk also about allowing more negative feelings. Some years ago, I had a rough time in my life, but I decided that I wouldn't let that make me negative and bitter. My relationships with a few friends and boyfriend changed at the same time, and I let other people maybe not be so kind to me, but I didn't mind. I thought that I just have to be the bigger person and understand why they behave like they behaved. But one day I understood that I haven't taken care of myself in the way that I should, and I understand that I had every reason to be upset and angry to these persons. I don't mean that you should let hate get the best of you, but it's really important to make boundaries and be first of all kind to yourself. So these seem to me to be related. How to work with anger, hatred and sadness. And it's not just all about being nice and friendly. Sometimes, actually, we're really feeling unfriendly, and we're actually full of hate and anger and sadness and really tricky things. I mean, in a kind of general way, one thing that we're doing here is we're learning to meet our experience, our emotional life, with a kind of simple presence, aren't we? Simple, kind presence. And this is a general sort of thing, but this is also a very powerful thing. When we're sitting here, maybe there's not much happening, or maybe there's a lot happening, but we're finding a posture in relationship to life and all of our emotions and experiences which supports the resolution of difficulty. It helps the places we get stuck, helps us learn how to get unstuck. So one piece of this puzzle is getting really clear on the kind of attitude and attention that we can keep alive in our act of being present with our life. If we can be present with our life in a certain way, then we can get really strong, deep confidence that whatever difficult emotion is there, it's workable. that we can stay, we can sense into it, we can learn how to not make it worse, we can learn how to find space around it. When I'm saying it, this is a difficult emotion. This is anger, resentment, sadness, hatred, these kind of things. We learn to own them. When we're present, we are able to say, okay, well, this person is really tricky for me, but this is my anger, really, more than anybody else's at this point. I'm the one who can do something about this more than anybody. So we take ownership, we take responsibility. It's like, okay, I'm going to have to find a way to work with this. I've got some clues. I know I can stop, I can be present, keep a welcoming, curious attitude, and see what I learn. And that helps us to come out of blaming other people for how we're feeling, which is a really important step in learning to digest these difficult things. It also means that when we then communicate with another person and we can say, you know, when that happened, I was really, really furious. When that happened, I was furious, and I'm still furious. Really difficult. If we've taken ownership of that, it's more likely that that's a useful communication with another person. If they can hear how you are feeling without you blaming them so much, they might be like, oh, okay, I can receive that actually. And it also helps you make a boundary. It's like, that's not going to happen again. That's not good. Sorry, that I can't go there again. That's not, you know, we say no. We learn to say no. But we learn to say no based on actually having taken ownership of a feeling rather than on blaming somebody else. So it's a more useful way of putting a boundary up and saying no. But the question how to work with intense negative feelings and thoughts like anger, hatred and sadness, that's a life's work, isn't it, really? It really is a life's work. I mean, I don't think there's a formula, but there's lots of things that I know are useful, and we'll be talking about them here. Grounded, mindful, curious, forgiving. And we don't want to condemn these things. If they really come into the practice, then we need to learn to work with them. Maybe we can say, okay, not now sometimes, and just do the metta. Maybe we can do that, but we can't always do that. So we have to find a way to work with them where it's not just about going back to the kind intention. The kind intention becomes the willingness to stay with the difficulty and see if we can sense it more deeply and work with it more deeply. Isn't it? Does that make sense? Anybody want to say anything on this one? Recognize, allow, investigate, non-identify. There's a bit of a formula that can be helpful. R-A-I-N. Recognize anger. Allow. Okay, I'm going to work with this. Make space. Investigate. What are you? And listen. And then non-identifying happens. This shifting that can happen. And some letting go can happen. It's just a basic context of insight meditation practice. Notice, make space, be curious, and trust. But then there's also getting specific with these things where you get into the content of angry stories and the content of sad stories, and it becomes a slightly different way of working. It becomes more of a therapeutic, in the psychotherapeutic mode and model, which is really, really helpful. I don't know why I don't feel quite satisfied about that answer, question, response thing, but is that enough for now on this one?
Could you clarify the non-identifying part?
Yeah, non-identifying part. Well, keep it simple, we realize that the experiences on the inside, our emotions, our anger, is actually kind of like the weather on the outside. It's something that happens as a natural phenomena, and it's largely out of our hands. So it's not so much our stuff and our issue that we have to work with. We do have to find a way to work with it, but what we're letting go of is the heaviness of making it so much about me and my anger, my sadness, my hatred. And we're starting to realize these are universal things. Even the sense of self is a universal experience. It's not personal. It's shared, it's universal, it's conditioned, it's changing. And so that when we start to see that, it develops space around the things. We can, the emotional content still happens, but it's like weather moving through the sky. And you know, when the weather moves through the sky, you don't really judge it, do you? You don't criticize it. When you go into the forest and you see the messy floor, all the leaves and the twigs and the mud and the bits of ice and whatever's there, you don't start judging the forest floor for being messy and having smelly things in it that are like a dead rat and you know, dog shit and fresh little sprouts of life happening. You don't judge it. It's just nature. It's the forest floor. But we do it to our own hearts, which is also just nature. So it's like, that's how I think about it. I think that's a helpful way to get a handle on the non-identifying. Could talk a lot more about it, really, but I want to try some of these other ones. God, these are really long. Metta practice and social fears. How metta works with this. How can it help? In what way? I'm thinking about not wanting to show yourself to others, maybe not trusting them enough, some bad experiences. There's more pieces to this. Well, social fears and being open with people. A big part of what we're doing here is learning to come back to a sense of okayness and safety, isn't it? Learning what we need to do from our own side, with our own efforts, our own decisions, what we can do to reconnect with a sense of safety, and that we to feel okay, to feel that we are okay, that we're loved, we're acceptable. That we can be kind of content and at ease just to be a normal person. That the peace that can come with that. Part of what we're learning is how to reconnect with that when we're here, through the act of presence, noticing the places we get tangled up, returning to our breathing, returning to the body, returning to the metta phrases. So, one thing that happens when we learn to meet our difficult feelings, and when we stick with it, we start to get a certain kind of confidence. Kind of confidence that we can work with difficult things. It's not a kind of confidence that's like glitzy. It's a hard-won confidence from scrabbling around in the really messy stuff. It's like we know that if it gets difficult, it's okay. I know I can take myself off, sit myself down, set up my practice, give my attention, and work with this and find a way to meet it and for it to be digested by love and presence and awareness and the rest of it. So I think practice gives us a kind of confidence in that way that can translate into social interactions. And also, the loving kindness practice, it strengthens another way to relate. We get familiar with how to relate in a friendly way, and that feels good. Metta practice and social fears, how metta works with this? Can it help in what way? Thinking about not wanting to show yourself to others, maybe not trusting them enough. Well, if there's a lack of trust there, or doubt, or worry, listen to that. It might be really important. It might be, okay, this isn't the time to be open. I've learnt to protect myself for whatever reason, and that serves its purpose. Don't push that away. That's to be respected, isn't it? We close, that has its purpose. So we let it happen. And we're also like aware that it has its limitations when we close down. It's like, yeah, I'm protecting myself, and at the same time it means I close myself off to people and I lose something from connect. I don't get the kind of connection that I could get if I'm closed. So we have both of those. So we're like curious. I'm allowed to be closed, that's good. That's important in its own way. So don't condemn that. And the fear, social fear, not to be condemned, that's to be, in a way, to be loved. So maybe it makes sense that the metta, the kindfulness, can address the fear and the social anxiety, whatever it is. You know, maybe it takes some time to open up. Maybe that's totally, totally fine. And at the same time, we have this practice where we can bring about a kind of friendliness. It's something we create. We bring it into being, and that's really helpful and healthy, and helps us get the nourishment that we need from connecting with people. The difficult person. We haven't gone through it yet, but what do you think about the whole of humanity as a race? That's not it. We do a lot of harm. Pollute, overpopulation, animal abuse to other people. I feel compassion and kindness to people naturally, but at the same time I have some loathing for humanity as a race, me included. Should I use the fourth kind in this situation? The fourth kindness, forgiveness, allowingness, compassion. In a way it's the same thing, isn't it? We have to learn how to work with our anger and in a healthy way. Anybody got any insights on this one? How to work with difficult people in formal metta practice in life? There's something, one way of understanding is that we develop the metta with people that it's easy for, friends. And we get really well resourced, we recharge the heart, we let this big ocean of loving kindness grow. We develop that, and then that helps us relate to our anger in a healthier way. It helps us come back from anger more quickly, recover from anger more quickly. So that is one thing that we learn, how to develop the strength of this, of the loving kindness. But then there's also the unavoidable engagement with the anger and the injustice and those kind of things. We have to find a way to feel them and digest them and work with them in the body, in the present, possibly with other people supporting us. Yeah, Sophia.
I had a coach. He was a prison guard, and we once asked him that how is it to work with the prisoners, that they are scary and they've done really bad things.
Mm.
And then he just told us that, well, he works at an adult's kindergarten. That like the people there are totally normal people,
mm.
like in their eyes. Give food to them, they play with them. And,
yeah.
and he told us that they're just normal people, but mm. they've done some really bad stuff. So that actually, or at least for myself, it gave me a really good way of thinking
mm.
about people that does bad things, or does bad things to me, or
mm.
they're just people. And when they've been born, nobody's bad.
Mm.
So maybe something bad happened to them, that kind of way.
Yeah, exactly. That's one piece, isn't it? When we look at the causes and conditions that are making somebody act in an unhelpful way, that helps us be forgiving and have compassion and not condemn them as a person. And at the same time, we still have to lock them up in jail sometimes.
Yeah, I was just came to my mind that because I've dealt and I still do occasionally more or less feel very strongly about this injustice in the world and all sorts of
yeah.
these kind of big large issues.
Big large issues.
Issues
yeah.
that I think the anger and sadness behind it, it's the helplessness.
Mm.
So, for me,
mm.
so,
mm.
you know, metta practice, well, first, I can use the logic, like, also these people who murder other people, they also suffer, and they want to, and their reasons, their different consequences, some things has happened, so these people do these things that they do.
Mm-hmm.
But then, I think I'm more interested about what are the feelings they these world situation and animal situation, all sorts of things. How they impact on me and what emotions. So, and usually it's this anger and helplessness and or sadness, something that, and I get the feeling that, well, I can't save the world, but maybe there's some sort of a small, I call it meta action.
Yeah.
like maybe there can be small gesture of kindness, for example, just to open a door to somebody,
mm-hmm.
just a little tiny thing that maybe that brings something good, at least
yeah.
for me.
Yeah.
So
that's very interesting.
So that somehow helps to carry the load. Or the suffering of the world and what's going on. And of course, if you're able and you have courage and resources, if you're able to do bigger actions, that's also, of course, must be good. But I have found more helpful the compassion practice just to be with this, all these sad things and angry things in the world.
Mm.
Somehow this compassion aspect has been more helpful for me than not the direct metta
yeah.
type of thing.
Yeah.
To be with the sufferings.
Yeah.
and also to understand what's going on in me at that point when I feel a lot of these types of things. Also to meditate or understand that, also to explore that.
Yeah.
So
thank you.
That came to my mind.
There's something empowering about our practice, isn't there? If we're feeling helpless, that can make it feel all the network can we just collapse. But when we learn, we find a certain kind of strength through our practice, and then we don't feel helpless. We're more likely to make a response from an empowered place. How are you doing? It's 8:20. Do you want? I mean, we've got lots more we could do. I slightly feel like end the retreat.
Extend
the retreat. Yeah, please.
The calling one might have to do something about injustice, to do something about the things that are wrong in the world, and align one's action with one's heart, with one's heart kind of yearns for in this regard, and actually acting out one's compassion makes it all feel much more bearable. No longer just witnessing, I'm no longer just a victim. And actually it's not about if I can save the world or not. I can be part of the force that's acting for hope in a wholesome manner in the world. And I'm joining millions of others. This fabrication of mankind as something it's a mind made idea that mankind is rotten because it's doing all of this. Mankind is doing all sorts of things, humankind, many kinds of things, and we can, one way of looking at it is that greed, hatred and illusion are problematic, maybe not the human mind, but the poisons in the mind.
Yeah.
That's something that we can work with.
We all have different responses, don't we? Some of us are called for direct action, some of us are called for slightly different types of action, and some of us, to honour that, actually,
not
the difference.
To lock down, but it
yeah.
Look like a certain type.
Certainly, yeah. I had a couple of questions that mentioned trauma, the word trauma. Really long questions. How to work with one's psychological history and emotional wounds of the past. Obviously, this is quite a big topic. What to say in a short, just a little bit of time about this one. Things that are really helpful for, I mean, in a way we've all got some kind of trauma, we've all got indented by life, haven't we? We've taken some knocks and we get influenced and we've inherited difficulties from events and from family and stuff. Something about working in the body, learning to find the kind of attention that's in the body, helps to release trauma. But also getting support from people who know what they're doing and working with them if it's really tricky trauma. Making sure you get support from other people. So there's finding somebody, a skilled person who can support you. But I think the body is right in the middle of it. I know Joseph Goldstein talks about working with trauma in meditation. He talks about titrating it. You know, titration is a chemical term, and you're dripping. You just drip in little drips. Working with it little bit by little bit. Not not letting it just blow up in your face. Old traumatic things. It sometimes feels like there's something we just this old and it's locked in us, and we have to be really gentle with it, I think, and just take little bites, not try and solve it all in one big push. Sorry, I think my brain's slightly not sharp this evening, and I'm struggling to find. Find more to say. I think we should probably come to an end. Is that all right? Yeah. So sorry if I didn't get through your lots of other fantastic questions and comments. Maybe we'll have another chance to speak about them at some point, either one to one or in another context here somehow. Okay, so let's have a period of for some walking or some movement before we come back and have a sit again at 8:45. So we've got 20 minutes or so before we come back. Okay.